Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with our special guest, Adams Bruder, who's playing the part of George Allman today, and John Clements. And we will be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on this show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the main Walter Anderson Nursery Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ken. Good morning, John.
Adams, welcome. Thank you very much for stepping in for George, who is in Alaska, I think, at this point.
That's correct.
Yeah. So looking forward to hearing about his trip when he gets back. So it's kind of getting towards the end of summer. We've had been a nice summer so far. It hasn't been brutally hot.
No, it's still good for planting and all. So people are still at the nurseries. Every time I'm at the nurseries, they're swamped.
Yeah, we have been busy. And there's a lot of stuff that's been busy. I'm still dealing with the rodent issue in my garden. The one that appears to have moved into the half oak barrel planter. It keeps eating the squash. I think I'm up to 10 squash now that it's eaten.
Wow.
And I tried the last series of things that I did was I brought home a 15 gallon sized gopher cage, the chicken wire gopher cage, and put that over the plants. He dug under that and ate them, and then decided to move into the barrel and has now burrowed into the soil in the barrel. So I tried using black cat traps to no avail. I tried baiting the black cat traps with squash greens. He avoided that and just went for the plants instead. Then I surrounded the hole with the black cat traps, and he dug away from the traps and came out a different way. So then I brought home a black hole trap, and he dug out the back way away from the trap. So now he's got a Maccabee trap in the run. We'll see what, we'll see if that takes care of him. But this has been a nightmare and it's just the one. It is just the one barrel. Nothing has been affecting anything else that's growing out there. But Adams, I think you win as far as the rat problem or the rodent problems are concerned.
Well, I definitely have issues up in Ramona. Last year, for instance, gophers, I caught about 315 gophers and 64 squirrels.
That's an insane amount of gophers.
I still have plenty of them this year. I've caught almost 50 squirrels this year. I haven't really kept track of the gophers, but that is way down this year. I'm probably only around 50 or so for the year so far.
Well, you made a big dent in them last year.
I did. It's also a lot drier up there this year. I think that really makes a difference too.
Do you think they just migrate over to wetter areas, or do you think they just expire?
There's just not as much food up there. Oh. There's a lot of open grassland areas around me, and those were dry for months. They didn't really start growing until the spring this year because we had the late rains. Then it did rain. They did finally grow, but I think they usually start multiplying around December. I start having issues November, December, and it was dry all the way through this year.
Wow. That's true.
Yeah, it has been really less of a problem this year for gophers for us too. It's markedly lower, and I think a lot of it has to do with rain. When there's really lush foliage around, the gopher population just goes up because they're able to sustain more. You know, all the babies live,
and that's true with a lot of animals in wildlife. When it's rainy, the rabbit populations tend to increase, and then as rabbit populations tend to increase, then you get more coyote activity. everything is all tied into that cycle.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see. This is the first time I've had, and it, I don't even have a major issue, but this is a major issue for me trying to get rid of this little thing. So I'll see what happens. I've got a couple more ideas, but it may just come to the point where I have to take that barrel out and throw it over the fence in the back and dump it out and start over again. That may be the only way I can get rid of them. So,
well, Adams, you said that you like to use the just good old fashioned black box trap. I do everything. And a lot of it depends on soil types. Mm-hmm. So I find in certain soils that trying to use the gopher hawk doesn't work very well. If it's very sandy, they don't work.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If it's too very, very dense DG, they don't work very well. So sort of have to have a lot of tools in your arsenal. And I learned from Jim Bishop, who's one of the ace gardeners in town, maybe the prettiest garden in San Diego. He lives on a hillside and he uses cinch traps, which I get through Grangettos. And those work very well on hillsides. So I use Maccabees, I use Black Box, I use Gopher Hawks, and I use cinch traps. And it all depends on the soil type and the geography.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's no way. I mean, a lot of my clients will say, do we have to kill them? Yes. lethal trapping is the only way you can deal with gophers.
I wouldn't be able to grow anything if I weren't out there trapping almost every day.
You're right.
A long time ago, like 40 plus years ago, there was a company that made windmills and they were called Clippity Clops. And we said, and I know about them because it was my job as a kid to put those things together. And I can't tell you how many of those things I put together, but it was a little wooden windmill. And on the back of the propeller were two little wooden blocks that as it would spin, those blocks would hit the main body of the windmill. And that percussive sound would transmit down through the stake. And supposedly it would, that they don't like that sound radiating through the soil. And it must have worked at least for a while because we sold thousands of those things. I mean, it was amazing how many of those we sold over the years. And then the company, I don't know what happened, but the company disappeared at some point and they were no longer available. And nobody's come up with something with that particular thing again. One thing that did come up were the battery-powered sonic repellents. And we started carrying probably about 30 years ago was when I remember they first started showing up on the market. Originally they were battery powered and then they went to solar power. And that's been a mixed bag. Hmm. I've heard some people say that they work extremely well and they haven't had any issues. And then I've heard people say that they don't work at all. But I think a lot of that also depends on soil and the type of soil, the type of soil that you have. Some soils are more conducive to transmitting the sound waves through the soil and some of them aren't. And I think, I can't tell you which is which, but I think that's what it was. And the soils that don't transmit the sound waves, they're not nearly as effective. But I've never tried them myself, but I was just thinking if we have those, I might have to stick one of those.
Give it a try.
Gets rid of that thing.
Well, honestly, I don't know how people's gardens can survive unless they effectively deal with rodents. Because if it's not the gophers, it's rats. I have a client in Mount Soledad area of La Jolla that rats eat everything. I mean, they chew the plants to the ground, let alone eating all the tomatoes and things like that. And so, again, they didn't want to trap. But there's no other way you could deal with these things.
A lot of times.
And ground squirrels. You know, I like to eat the things from my garden as much as the rodents.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta keep up on it. And, you know, and as far as gardening is, as far as edible plants is concerned, you really don't want to be putting out baits and things like that. I mean, there's a whole other myriad of issues that go along with baits that you just would rather avoid. You know, for me, I've said for a long time, I think the most effective overall trap that I've seen for as far as gophers are concerned is the Maccabee trap. It's been around forever. They're a little sketchy to set, but once you learn how to do it, it's it's pretty quick and easy to do. You just got to keep your fingers out of the tongs, and you do it right. And they are extremely effective. And because it goes down into the, it goes down into the actual run itself from the top, you don't really need to worry so much about the soil component or mm-hmm. what the soil is made of, because mm-hmm. you're sticking it into the run.
I have used those. I have found that there are some gophers that just don't want to touch those, though. Mm. They will completely avoid them. So what, and those same gophers tend to also want to avoid the black box traps mm-hmm. as well. So what I've actually done with the black box traps is pack the inside with mud from the tunnel, so the gopher really doesn't even recognize it as a trap. It just
starts burrowing and burrows into the trap.
And it just, well, I didn't fill it with mud, but what I did was I lined the inside of the trap with mud.
Well, and
then the gopher would work, because there's some gophers that just do not want to enter that trap.
I have heard, it's not scientific, only anecdotally, mm-hmm. that they can smell mm-hmm. the human contact on the traps. And that was one of the things that
I've heard that's not true. And I used to wear gloves and keep the traps rinsed out. Mm-hmm. I found that's a waste of the time. I've caught three gophers in the same day with the mm-hmm. same trap without even rinsing it.
Okay. Well, yeah,
with rat traps, absolutely you need to clean them, because they mark them when they spray. And then they can, their sense of smell is incredible. So I use Dawn. The only place I would ever recommend Dawn dishwashing liquid in garden use would be to wash your traps with those for the rats, because it cuts the grease. Mm-hmm. Because the rats also carry on their feet little pads that secrete this noxious little musky oil. Mm. And that's why you can see where rats run. You can actually see a dark streak like grease.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. And so the Dawn does help to get your traps clean for rats. So I do recommend it for that. But gophers, I don't think can tell. But I do put shredded carrots and chopped up cilantro occasionally at the bottom, at the end of a box trap. And that seems to draw them in a little more. So no, I don't know.
I guess they don't think the cilantro tastes like soap then.
No, I think they're in the non-soap mode of cilantro. They should like it.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with Adam Ritter and John Clements. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with Adams Bruder, who is setting in for George Allman today. And John Clem, just before the break, we were talking about rodents in your garden and how to control them. One thing that came out a number of years ago, and there was a lot of talk about it, and I think a lot of people were trying it for getting rid of gophers, was using Juicy Fruit gum. Mm-hmm. And I believe that has been debunked. I don't think that's going to work. And you know, with the price of gum these days, you're better off just investing in some traps.
Every once in a while, someone comes in and still claims that it works for them. So,
well, mm-hmm. if it is, that is news to me. You know, I remember a while back there was a rat bait that was on the market. I don't know if it still is or not, but it was basically grain mixed with cement, dry cement. And then the rats would eat the grain, and as it got into their digestive system, the water in their digestive system would activate the cement and solidify, and that dispatch the rats. I don't think that's on the market anymore. So I don't know if it didn't work or if it was banned or what happened, but I do remember that was going on at one time. During the break, we were talking about rodent problems, and you brought up the issue of voles, which for a long time I didn't think they were in this area, but they definitely are.
Because
I had them in my yard, and one of the telltale signs of voles, especially if you have a lawn area, is they will eat little runways through the mm-hmm. and little pathways through the lawn. Yeah. And then they follow those pathways when they're moving around. And we had that we had a rose planter out back that had some ground cover in it, and we could see them. They would come out of the ground cover, and then they would get into their little runways on the lawn and move around. We haven't had to deal with them that much lately. But when I was back east a couple of years ago for my son's graduation, Mel and I were walking to a restaurant for dinner one night, and there was a big grass area out in front of the center where the restaurant was, and it looked like a road map. Mm. I mean, there were so many little trails all over that lawn. It was amazing. Mm. But they all the trails went back to a planter area that mm-hmm. had ground cover and bushes in it. So that's where they were living. But right. they used the lawn just as a freeway system. Mm. And they just, I would say probably 100 feet or more of little trails carved mm. out in there in that lawn. It was pretty impressive. But the voles will have, voles and other rodents will cause problems with girdling.
Right. That's the big problem.
And you said you've yeah. seen it on citrus trees.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I had a client with a beautiful grapefruit tree that about 6 inches from the bottom of the tree and completely around it, about a 6-inch swath.
That'll do it.
Just completely girdled the tree. And so if you do that to a tree, it's dead.
It's done.
It's just done. And it doesn't take that long. And so that's the big problem. And for whatever reason, I always see the problem. I don't know about your experience, Adams, but with voles, I always see the damage on the citrus. They don't seem to go after the stone fruits and the palms, but they can be a real problem. And I recently had a Vitex purpurea trifolia, the purple lilac, mm-hmm. where one
Persian lilac had
just completely girdled one of those. And they do go after Wheeler's dwarf pittosporum.
Yes, they do.
So if you see dieback on some of your shrubs like that, just out the fact, look at the base and see if maybe it's been girdled. It could be voles.
I would say there's very little that gets on Wheeler's dwarf pittosporum. Maybe scale every once in a while, maybe some mealybug, but that doesn't usually show up as a dieback. But with Wheeler's dwarf pittosporum, it's such a tight growing plant that if you get a branch that just dies in the middle of the plant or a section of the plant, I would say probably a good 90% of the time mm-hmm. there, if you look deep into it, there's rodent issues in there whether it's voles or rats, something has chewed the bark off of that particular branch and it only affects that branch, but that branch is dead and then mm-hmm. you have to cut it out. But that's a very good indicator that you might have some rodent issues going on in your yard if you have Wheeler's dwarf and they start disappearing mm-hmm. Start dying back like that.
I've definitely seen that here at the nursery with several people bringing photos wondering why they have one branch that's mm-hmm. dead or half their plant's dead, and usually back the whole branch back mm-hmm. to where the live growth is, and you can look on it and actually see the teeth marks in the branches. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear, and once you show it to them, they understand that they can see that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's very, very noticeable. There's definitely a telltale sign that something has removed the bark from that. And then of course, you get the argument that I never see any. No, you don't. Well, for one thing, it's inside of this plant that you can't see inside of. And you know, a lot of times they're moving around at night and mm. you don't see them out.
Have you ever had vole damage on anything but citrus?
I have had voles in my garden after wet years. Last year I had voles, and I think 3 or 4 years before that I had voles. They really like cucumbers, squash. Ooh. They'll make all their little tunnels through all my squash and vine plants. And they like to just chew a little bit off each one. But last year I thought, well, I'm going to put down some straw mulch, really help with the heat up there in Ramona. And the voles just moved into that like crazy.
Wow.
They would come up underneath and then eat out the whole inside of the melons and actually were just decimating my cucumber crop last year.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
This year, dry weather, haven't had a single one.
Hmm. You know what we've noticed showing up on I mentioned it before, we have the green belt behind our house and we have a trail camera set up just mm-hmm. to see what's moving around back there at night. And one of the things that we've had quite a bit show up of within the past month or so are kangaroo rats.
Oh my.
And you can, it looks like a rat. it's got a little bit bigger ears, but it has a super long tail with a big tuft of fur right at the end of the tail. And we see those fairly frequently out foraging around in the green belt. They don't appear to be eating any of the plants that are growing. They just look like they're foraging for seeds or nuts or something on the ground. We've seen quite a few of those. And then about a week or so ago, there was a small mound on the green belt that has some foliage and stuff growing on it. And it's at the base of a scrub oak that's growing. And there was a coyote something had piqued its interest in that, because it spent about 10 minutes circling that little mound of growth, and you could see it poke its nose down into it. And there was something in there. I don't know if it was probably was a kangaroo rat, because that's the most that I've seen of smaller rodents moving around back there. But something, it was trying to get something. We didn't actually see that it got anything, but it was looking. And then you said you've seen a natural predator up in your area.
I one time did see a weasel up in my area. My neighbors have reported seeing that as well. But they will wipe out squirrel and gopher population. Mm-hmm. So they're very tricky to see, but if you get one, it's a good animal to have around. They will wipe out those rodents for you.
And maybe somebody could start a breeding program to let more weasels go.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they do a much better job than, was it the mongoose that they brought into
Hawaii.
To get rid of the rats and the sugar cane. Yeah. And their cycles were off 180 degrees. Was it the mongoose is diurnal and the rats are nocturnal. So they never saw each other. So both of the populations exploded and did not. Sounds like a good idea, but not such good consequences, unfortunately.
Well, my property in Julian, across the road from me, a lovely woman named Poppy and her husband lived there. And so we talk about predators, you know, and I think, oh, well, foxes and coyotes and things. And her husband said, Poppy, come here. Look, the neighbor's dog, doggone him. Look, a neighbor's dog is on the top of our picnic table out here. And so she comes running to look and she said, Bob, that's not the neighbor's dog. That's a mountain lion.
Oh, geez.
so you know, it's just depending on where you're at, the size of the predator can definitely increase.
One thing that we've spotted a couple in our yard. I haven't seen any in the green belt. Bobcats, and there's a lot of people in Scripps Ranch are seeing bobcats. Mm. I've lived there for 30 years. And it's just within the past couple of years that bobcats have started showing up more, and they're big. Mm-hmm. The two that we spotted in our yard were pretty juvenile. My neighbors two doors down on their surveillance camera one night in the open space behind their house, they actually spotted a mountain lion.
Mm.
And I don't live in rural Scripps Ranch. I mean, I live right mm-hmm. in the middle of Scripps Ranch North. Other than green belts moving through the area, there's not a lot of unmolested open space. So they're out there.
Oh, yeah.
Just leave them alone. Hope you don't run into one. one of you guys had mentioned that skunks will actually go after rodents too.
Yeah, I have seen skunks killing rats.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah. Skunks are in the weasel family, and they are mostly carnivorous.
Well, I know they'll do a number on your lawn if you have grubs in your lawn. That's another one of those things where people bring something's digging in my lawn, and they show you what's going on. And it's a skunk. You've got grubs in there.
Either digging in their lawn or digging in their compost pile.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. So they will go after them. So if you have something that's digging up your lawn, treat your lawn for grubs. Mm-hmm. If you want to use the beneficial nematodes, mm-hmm. you can do that. Or there's other control. Well, actually, I think spinosad will control.
Spinosad
will. Yeah. So that's another natural control that you can use. Mm-hmm. You get rid of the grubs and you're not going to have a problem with the skunks mm-hmm. anymore. They will move on looking for food somewhere else. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Bruder and John Clements. We're going to take a quick break and we're back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with Adams Bruderer, sitting in for George Allman and John Clements. One thing this year that has been absolutely crazy is milkweed. We've had record sales of milkweed this year. The amount that we have moved through the store is just phenomenal. And I think that's industry-wide, I think that's the case. Some of our growers, they ran out. They have none left. And right now I've noticed there's a lot of monarchs on the property. The butterflies are all over the place and they're feeding on the blooming stuff and moving around. So it's been an incredible year for that. And that also brings up the question of, if people are having problems with their monarchs, the difference between a monarch that's been poisoned by a pesticide and a monarch that's been infected or has died from other causes. And I've found some interesting information on that. But before I get into that, one of the things that we had mentioned in the past, and I did find some documentation on it, is when people run out of milkweed and milkweed is not available, one of the things that you can do is the caterpillars will feed on fresh butternut squash. Wow. So you can cut the squash in half and put the larva on the squash and they will feed on the squash and hopefully get large enough that they can pupate. But that if you run out of milkweed and you can't find milkweed, fresh butternut squash, I think I would probably try to find organic butternut squash just to make sure that it hasn't been treated with anything. Because that can be a problem. But some of the information that I found was that one of the indications that a caterpillar may have been exposed to a pesticide is that they tend to spit or vomit green fluid when they react to poison. Whereas if it's a bacterial problem, we'll get into this a little bit later, they don't do that. It's a different mechanism that they work with. But they will also spit up green fluid as a defensive mechanism. So it can be difficult to tell. And it also says that this green fluid is close to the same color as a caterpillar's hemoglyph, which is its blood. And it's easy to tell the difference. The hemoglyph dries to a dark color, nearly black, in less than 5 minutes. So you can keep an eye out on that. It says, other than poisons, the other primary cause of green spit is a defensive reaction to being disturbed. Some species automatically spit green fluid at the slightest touch. Others must be pestered quite a bit before they resort to spitting green fluid.
Sounds like The Exorcist.
We are very diligent in working with our growers and making sure that they are not spraying any of their plants. And a good indication that a plant has not been treated for anything is if it has aphids on it. Mm-hmm. And milkweed is an aphid magnet. It's one of the most aphid infested plants I think I've ever seen. So if you're out shopping for milkweed and you see plants that have aphids on them, you're pretty safe with them. That you don't have to worry about them as much.
A lot of people come in and want to know how to treat for the aphids. So generally I just recommend just spray them off with a hard stream of water. And that way you're not hurting the caterpillars at all.
Yeah. It doesn't bother the caterpillars, but you got to be careful though, that you don't wash the immature caterpillars or the eggs off.
That
so,
is true.
Yeah. Yes. If you can let them go. It's not going to be very sightly, but it's definitely safe. But one thing that had never occurred to me until I was reading this article about it, is a lot of people that have pets and indoor and outdoor pets use topical flea controls on their pets. Some of those topical flea controls include imidacloprid, which is a neonicotinoid. And in the article, it said that if you pet your animals and then you go and handle caterpillars, which I personally think you should try not to handle caterpillars as much as possible. I mean, if you need to move them, I would cut the branch. When I had to move them, I would just cut the branch off that it was on and then move the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And just don't touch the caterpillar. But if you have pets and you're using a topical flea control, you definitely don't want to be handling the caterpillars, because that same topical flea control that's working on your animals can kill the caterpillars if they get in contact with it. And apparently they can get enough contact from just what gets picked up on your by touching the caterpillars. So that's one of those things that never would have hurt me, but it makes perfect sense. And then there was another article on the Monarch Butterfly Garden website, and it's Monarch Diseases, Parasites, and Caterpillar Killers. And it's a list of things that can cause problems if you're raising monarchs in your yard. One that I've been dealing with for a couple of years, tachinid flies. Yeah. And just
which,
and
normally we want in the garden.
You typically want them around because they're predators for things other than monarchs, but unfortunately the monarchs fall into that category. So like I said, I'm not planting milkweed this year. I'm planting lots of plants for them to blooming plants for them to come for the butterflies to come in and feed on as far as the nectar is concerned, but they're not laying their eggs. And I'm hoping within a year or two, the tachinid fly population in my garden will either drop to a point where it's not a problem, or it's just going to be wiped out completely just by the lack of food source.
Yeah. So sometimes the brutal side of nature, I think people don't like to accept this. We want the monarchs, but then we don't want to have the tachinid flies. Well, I'm always planting other plants to draw in predatory insects. So that helps in my garden, you know, planting yarrow and cilantro and parsley and letting them all go to seed, because I'm bringing in butterflies with that, but also ladybug larvae and tachinid flies, because you want an entire ecosystem, a biome that functions. But we want to exclude sometimes the aggressive predators.
And,
you know,
and the whole ecosystems work very, very well until something gets thrown out of whack, you know, where you run into, and that's when you run into problems. I think they figured that out up in Wyoming,
right,
with the wolves, when they started controlling the wolf populations, then other things just got completely out of hand. And then once the wolves started being reintroduced into the areas, then those other problems started disappear. So it really is amazing how the system works if you let it work, but you throw one thing off and it can cause some real problems. But yeah, tachinid flies, as far as monarchs are concerned, they can be a real problem and very difficult to control. Let's see what else. So much longer article than I expected it to be. One of the other ones that you hear about a lot, OE, ophrocytis, electroscuria. I know I pronounced that wrong, but OE is, and it's a protozoa parasite that attacks monarchs. And it's one that over time, its populations can build up to the point where it can be a real problem. And that was one of the problems that people were stating about tropical milkweed, in that because it doesn't go dormant, it allows the OE populations to increase to the point where it can be very detrimental to the monarch populations. The easiest way to get rid of that or to eliminate that problem mm-hmm. is to cut it back. Right. Or cut back your milkweed. Just get rid of it. If it doesn't, the tropical milkweeds typically won't go dormant as easily in our area. Mm-hmm. So end of October, November, just cut it down to the ground mm-hmm. and then throw it away. Don't just leave it there, but get rid of it. And then that eliminates a big chunk of the OE population. And you can kind of start over from mm-hmm. there in spring when things start coming back. So that's another one that's a big issue. Another one that I had never heard of before until a customer mentioned it at our San Diego store a few weeks ago, Black Death. NVP, nuclear polyhedrous virus. And when they get infected with that, the caterpillars will turn black and then liquefy. This is like something out of a horror movie. Also creates an incredibly rancid smell, which I don't typically go around smelling dead insects, but apparently somebody does.
Wow.
So there's that information as well. But yeah, the Black Death is, and how it came up was one of our customers in San Diego had come in to complain that they had gotten some milkweed from us, and it must have been treated because their caterpillars died after they ate it. And then they came back within a week and said, no, it wasn't treated. I was wrong. It was Black Death that got them, because that's what happened to the caterpillars. They turned black and died, and it was the it wasn't a pesticide. It was that particular vector that did him in.
You know, one thing, and I have no idea. This is just some hypothesization here. I'm thinking about the more that we keep the monarchs around in one location, which is really, it's changing the ecology for monarchs now. They used to migrate between Mexico and essentially Monterey Peninsula. Now they're all around. The more you keep things as a resident population, I'm sure that probably increases the likelihood they're going to spread disease to each other.
That could, I would think so.
I think we just don't think through these things when we start to mess with the ecology.
And I think it goes back to the whole ecosystem where you throw one of the variables out of whack, and it starts to change things around. And we're going to talk about that more. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Ritterer and John Clements. We'll be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Ritterer and John Clements. We've been talking about some of the maladies that can affect monarch butterflies, and based on the great season that we've had so far this year, as far as monarchs are concerned, the amount of milkweed that we've been going through, and just the amount of butterflies that we have been seeing. You were during the break, you were mentioning a butterfly that we don't see that much anymore that used to be around a lot. It was morning cloaks.
It's that beautiful dark brown butterfly with a little white edging on the wing.
White edging and some little tiny blue spots.
Little blue spots,
Come to think of it, I haven't seen any in quite a while either.
Yeah, and that used to be a very, very common butterfly in San Diego. And my parents, when I was a kid, had a Chinese evergreen elm in the front yard. A lot of people did. Yeah, thousands and thousands of caterpillars that would eat the leaves on that. And so I think we inadvertently, unknowingly affect our own ecology around us. So you don't see many Chinese elms anymore. Is that the reason the morning cloaks aren't around? I don't know. There used to be a little butterfly called a skipper that we used to see when I was a kid in elementary school. They would be on gazanias all the time.
Oh, is that the little orange one?
That little orange butterfly.
Size of a nickel?
Yeah. I never see them anymore.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when when you mentioned the morning cloaks, I haven't seen one of those in a long time. We used to catch them all the time.
Sure,
they love gazanias.
Yeah, they would be all over gazanias. I can't think of the last time that I saw one.
I can.
And so I think we become hyper focused on. Trust me, I'm not trying to diss the monarchs here. I love the monarchs, but I have a client that has a beautiful passion fruit vine growing on the side of her house. It is absolutely stunning. Well, at the same time, that's there. You know, the predator that goes out, not predator, but the herbivore that wants to eat the passion vine is the Gulf fritillary butterfly.
Yeah.
So, you know, concurrent with this beautiful passion fruit vine she's got, she had caterpillars all over it from the Gulf fritillaries, but she also had probably 200 butterflies flying in her backyard. That's a beautiful butterfly.
Yeah, it is very
pretty. And so if you want to expand the other butterflies in your garden, I think sometimes we just focus too much on one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so plant some passion fruit vines. You'll have some cool butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
Let the ugly bird poop butterflies eat your citrus.
Yeah, because they don't do that much.
Anything.
No, they really don't.
No. Yeah. And then you get that gorgeous giant swallowtail.
Yeah. Really
and so I'm frequently planting cilantro and parsley, aegis, because I'm also trying to attract the swallowtails.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, no disrespect to the monarch people, but think about expanding your feed supplies for other things. And then I do just wonder, anecdotally, well, what's happened to the skippers? What's happened to some of the other butterflies we no longer see?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. Growing up in Bay Park, the street that I lived on, between the two streets, we had alleys in the backyard. There were alleys that ran all through a lot of Bay Park. And as kids, we used to spend a lot of time in the alley playing. And one of the things that grew pretty commonly in those areas, just a weedy, unkept area in the alleys, was anise.
Yeah.
Wild anise.
We called it wild licorice. When
yes,
we were kids.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And it was all over the place. And I remember as a kid, we'd stop and see it. And it always had caterpillars on. Mm-hmm. And it was anise swallowtails.
Yeah.
And you just don't, well, I can't remember the last time I saw, not that I'm prowling around in alleys behind people's houses, but I can't remember the last time I saw wild anise growing anywhere mm-hmm. in San Diego. But there again, that was another host for an absolutely beautiful,
yeah,
beautiful butterfly.
I had that growing in my yard growing up too. I don't know if any's still growing in my parents' yard or not, but that was there my whole childhood as well.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I think we used to call it Indian chewing gum, and we would go and break off the dried branches of it, the dead branches, and peel the bark off of it. It had that really mm-hmm. spongy interior. So if we didn't have gum, we would go and find the dead anise plants and chew on the center. I don't recommend that.
No.
I remember doing that as a kid, and also eating my fair share of sour grass, the yellow oxalis, which I don't see that much anymore either. That was all over the place. And I just don't see it that much. You know, talking about things, hosting plants in your yard, it brings up an interesting point. And I've mentioned it on the show before. One of the great things to see if you're ever in Key West, which I highly recommend, is the Butterfly Conservatory back there. And when you go into the conservatory, it's in this beautiful steel and glass Victorian style greenhouse. It is absolutely beautifully landscaped with the most lush tropical landscape you will ever see. And it has this meandering pathway that runs all through the greenhouse, and they have waterways and ponds. They have butterfly feeding stations all over the place. All of the plant material and there's butterflies everywhere. Mm. All kinds of butterflies. They're flying all over the place all the time. All the plants that are in there are absolutely pristine.
Mm.
Nothing is eaten because they don't plant host plants. They have there's a few host plants that are in there for butterflies that they want to keep breeding on their own. Most of the stuff they import, it's a USDA approved and controlled facility. But the ones that they do allow to breed, they plant the host plants in the back, kind of like we've talked about with like night blooming jasmine and things like that. You plant it in the back and you screen it so that you can't see it from the front. All the stuff that you can see as you're walking through the place is absolutely pristine. The host plant, but because they're not host plants, and the butterflies will not lay their eggs on them, so the caterpillars don't develop. But the host plants are, there are some host plants in there. They're hidden. They're tucked away out of view of the general public.
You know, when we think about host plants too, maybe people don't think about it this way, but maybe I'm unique in this, but I don't like to spray the tomato hornworms and kill them, because what comes from a tomato hornworm? A sphinx moth.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything more magical to see at night during the summer than this huge sphinx moth.
They're huge.
They're huge. And I just think it's such a glorious sight to see. So I usually coexist with the tomato hornworms. I figure, you know, maybe I have fewer tomatoes, but I really like to see the sphinx moth.
When you can see them, it's literally, they can be bigger than a hummingbird.
Oh yeah,
they're massive.
I usually don't have too much issue with the hornworms at my house. The roadrunners come along and steal them off my tomato plants.
Wow.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Roadrunners.
Roadrunners come along. They I see them hunting through my tomatoes, and so I usually get a little bit of damage, but then the roadrunners just clean up the caterpillars.
Wow. Well, that's one way to do it.
Yeah.
I know chickens will eat them too if you pick them off. Some of the other things that will affect monarchs, Pseudomonas is a bacterial disease found in soil and on plants, and that can cause the chrysalis to suffer black death. Mm. That's another thing. If you see a monarch chrysalis that turns black rather than turning clear, which they do just before the monarchs emerge, but if it turns black, something has parasitized it. That's what we would see in our yard. And if it's a tachinophyte, there's usually a small hole in the chrysalis, and a lot of times there's a string of goo that the larva slide down out of the caterpillar or out of the chrysalis once they mature. So that's another one to watch out for. And here's one that's interesting too, that I hadn't thought of. Trichogramma wasps.
Oh yeah.
Which are typically beneficial.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
But they can go after monarchs as well. So if you want monarchs in your yard, you might think twice about introducing more Trichogramma wasps into your yard, because it can be a problem. Chalcid wasps, that's one I'm not familiar with.
I'm not familiar with that.
It's a mini parasitic wasp that stalk caterpillars, and they parasitize it. Seems like right after they form a chrysalis, and that can be a problem with them as well. Dehydration, which is interesting considering that they're eating water-filled plants, but yeah, that can be a problem as well.
They need to carry little water bottles.
Yeah. make sure that you're
hydrate.
Make sure that your plants are well irrigated. And another obvious one that gets used a lot in gardens, BT.
Oh, sure.
Same thing that'll take out tomato hornworms will take out your monarchs. So be very, very careful if you're using anything with Bacillus thuringiensis in it. Same thing with spinosad.
Right.
That's another one that just wipes out chewing insects.
And I'm seeing horrible problems on bougainvillea right now with the caterpillars.
Oh yeah,
on the bougainvillea. So if you're spraying all your bougainvillea down with BT or with spinosad, guess what, folks? you are going to hurt the butterfly populations in your garden.
It's going to be a problem. These are all unintended consequences.
Right.
And, you know, and a few of those things that we mentioned are all very good practices for organic gardening, but it all goes back to that whole ecosystem, though, the biome, and you start changing those variables around, and you can cause some pretty serious consequences or other unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying don't do it, don't practice those things, but just be aware of what you're doing. And my whole thought is my thought has always been do the least amount mm-hmm. possible to get the results that you want. And about the safest way to do it.
Yep.
You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with Adams Bruderer. Thank you, Adams, for sitting in with us today.
All right. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah. And John Clements. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.